Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Time for Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good show today. Very good people. We're going to hear from Bethany, one half of the sensational musical sister duo called the Erickson's, and we'll sample their new CD called The Wild. We'll also travel to the studio slash workshop of Eric Lee. Yes, that Eric Lee, the visual artist who produces stunning murals and wispy scenes of everyday life, still life in yesteryear. But this time, we'll be talking with Eric Lee, the maker of drums. And I wish you could see them while we talk. Hey, maybe visit the website oliversnaredrums.com and scroll while we yak. That's a possibility. Jim Oliver stops by with Stephen Mitchell with a preview of The Diary of Anne Frank, which he's directing for the Barron Spotlighters. And guess what? The art tours and the autumn roads that lead us within them continue this weekend. It's the Fresh Art Studio Tour, representing 15 studios and galleries where many more artisans will await your arrival. Jean Acola, herself an artist and gallery owner, started FAST, that's the acronym, the Fresh Art Studio Tour, FAST, some 15 years ago. Do you know that? How's it looking after 15 years? That's a pretty nice milestone.
Yeah, I'd say it's looking very good. It's very well established. People are familiar with it. We get lots of repeat folks. And, we're keeping steady. The artists are busy working and keeping the quality up. So, yeah, all in all, it's very good.
How does this year's tour differ from, for instance, the first tour? Have you learned a lot?
Yes. That's a tough question, huh? I mean, basically, it's bigger.
Yeah.
And, you know, like in the early days, you know, we were very low budget, and we just had our little printed flyer that was, you know, one color on one color kind of thing. And now, well, eventually, Pierce Pepin Electric Co-op, which is our electric co-op, sponsored our brochure quite a while back, and they've been gracious enough to continue that. So that's allowed us to have a really nice four-color brochure, and that kind of, I think, tells the folks that this is a pretty good quality show, and, you know, I think it reflects accurately, anyway,
sure,
what we have. We've learned to try and not go for volume, but to go for quality, and to so our artists, we have a nice variety. We don't have, like, all pottery or all jewelry or, you know, all paintings. We have a pretty good variety of artwork. So we have textiles, jewelry, you know, 2D, like, photography and painting, and, yeah.
You know, the appeal of this tour is often the place, isn't it?
Right. And one thing I realized as I was trying to write something about the art tour rather than the typical who, what, where, when, and why, which, you know, after 15 years gets to be a little blasé,
sure,
I realized, you know, the artists are being very creative with the spaces that they work in. And because we have, for example, we have at least two studios that are former barns, and we have two of our sites which are former schoolhouses. We have a number of them that are in old houses, you know, that have been converted into working spaces and galleries like my own. We even have a chicken coop that's been, not an art studio, but the chicken coop is made from a 1940s bread truck, so it's just kind of a fun little thing to go check out. That's at the Linda Day Bruce Dunlap Studio.
Oh, sure, sure. So, yeah, Pierce and Pepin Counties is the location. There is one, and I'll go through the villages in a minute, but there's one village. I mean, oh, let's do it now. Pepin, Stockholm, Maiden Rock, Durand. Then comes Ella. I've never heard of Ella. Why haven't I ever heard of Ella?
Well, it's really a boat landing at this point rather than a village, but it's it was actually a fairly big a town at one time because it's on the Chippewa River. And it was called Shoe Fly, in, you know, way back like 120 years ago or something. And, of course, it was a big logging stop. There was an old hotel there. And Ella, the one site that's close to Ella is the Little Plum Schoolhouse, which is just south of Ella on County Road N.
Okay. And there is Plum City, there is Arkansas, and there is Bay City as well.
Right. Well, those, a lot of those are rural. For example, the Bay City site is John Turula's site. You know, so if people, you know, people want to, when it's a tour, you need a map. So yeah, you can pick them up at all of the sites. And if you're coming from Eau Claire, my gallery in Durand would be the obvious spot to pick up a map and a brochure. And I'm right on Highway 25 South as you come into Durand, and right on at the intersection of 2nd Avenue East. If you're coming, say, from the south, you'd probably hit, maybe you'd hit Pepin. Mm-hmm. And down there, just look for the yellow and yellow signs with red lettering or yellow signs with red arrows, uh-huh, and that'll help direct you to the tour sites. Other than that, you could, of course, also go on the website to freshart.org to pick up a map, mm-hmm, or actually you can download and print it.
15 artists, studios, and galleries, 15 years. Is that just a coincidence?
Yes, it is.
You finally got to that, the golden birthday, I guess they call it.
Right.
Yeah, are you kind of, I mean, there's a lot of art tours around, and thankfully they're staggered on other weekends, but are you kind of the granddad or grandmom of art tours?
Well, we call the one down around Baraboo, Madison, the mother of all tours, but we are the mother up here in this part of the state, in western Wisconsin. We were, the first art tour in western Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the stops so that we have them. I mean, we can go to the website, obviously, mm-hmm, but since we're on the radio, let's do a little marketing here.
Okay, so site number one, of course, is mine in Durand, and I feature paintings, and also I'm going to have some demos showing how people do fine art books, like handmade books.
Okay.
Site number two is Linda Day, Bruce Dunlap. And Bruce is a painter. He works in acrylic, real colorful, whimsical work. And then Linda has pottery that's also reflective of very colorful and reflective of those themes. They will have a wood turner as a guest. Dick Lee is his name. Site three is in Plum City, or right outside of Plum City. It's the Wendy Ike Studio, and she's into equine or horse art. She does paintings, and she'll have guest artists Kay Garrity and Penny Siasia. I'm sorry if I might not be pronouncing that right. They're a photographer and a quilter. Site four is also a Plum City, out in the middle of Pepin County, actually, and it's a Little Plum Pottery. That's Art and Art Gannett and his wife, Barbara Anderson. They've been on the tour for many years. Site five is down in Pepin. That's the Banach Jewelry Studio. Rebecca, who's been running that for probably 20 years or so, was trained as a jeweler, but she'll be demonstrating wax carving of jewelry. And site six is Barbara McElrath Studio. She's a painter. She has a cool space. It's a big old barn that's had a beautiful renovation done just north of Pepin on County Road N. Her guests are Dodie Logue doing painting and drawings, and Dodie's sister Mary Logue, the textile artist as well as a writer. Site seven in Maiden Rock is Cultural Cloth. They have created a business where they bring in the cultural artwork of women from all over the world. They have featured artist Leah Werner, who's a ceramic sculpture artist.
Okay.
Eight is Maiden Rock Inn. It's in a big old schoolhouse. It's been turned into an inn, and their guest artist will be Christine Foster doing paintings and drawings, and Kristen Smith Proctor with silk scarves, watercolor, and mixed media, and then Sue's Craft doing acrylic painting. Nine is Black Cat Farmstead with Mikkelbist and Sears in rural Stockholm. They've moved an old house onto their property and turned it into a fiber studio. And then they also have a large-scale sculpture studio. Andrew will be demonstrating spinning wool and weaving at their site. 10 is Gail Pomerening Studio, sort of between Plum City and Maiden Rock in the country. And she's been on the tour for many years. She's a great pastel artist. Her guest artist is Mary Jackson from Rock Falls.
Okay.
She's doing watercolor and some gourd art. Site 11, Pepin Farm Pottery, is above Maiden Rock that overlooks the Mississippi River. That's run by Peter and Mary Deneen and Martha Winter, and they'll have handmade pottery and salt kiln pottery, and they have also some other potters, Paul and Denise Morris, lots of pottery to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
Site 12 is Flaming Fire Art Studio. That's Kay Lutke. She's a ceramic artist, you know, tiles that have some relief to them, and her guest is Sue Philbin doing nature printing. Oh, they also have a guest artist, Julie Henriksen, doing one-of-a-kind wearable art for women. 13 is the Abode Gallery in Stockholm. They will have featured artist Maria Dudley Kowalski doing oil and watercolor. At 14, Little Plum Schoolhouse, we have three artists there. It's a beautiful little schoolhouse that's about 9 miles north of Pepin on County Road N. There's also going to be a chili feed there. The artists at that site are Yvonne Wilkin, who's a great quilter, and Beth Tabor with textile art, and Matt Anderson, a young new painter in the area. Finally, site 15 is John Cerulli. He's been on our tour for many, many years. He's in rural Bay City, and he does real colorful tile work and sculptural work. He'll have guest artist Margie Ballwers doing clay tiles and Mark Newbel with some hammered jewelry.
Well, I have to say, I'm always happy when guests are prepared, and you were prepared. Well, congratulations on 15 years, and I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend, and I hope everybody out there listening considers it a lot of fun, and it's a great way to spend a weekend.
It should also be perfectly timed for the fall color. The maples are just starting to get kind of peachy orange down here, so this weekend they should be at their peak.
Yeah. Gina Cola, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Al.
Remember, it's tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day, the 15th Fresh Art Studio Tour. The website, again, is freshart.org.
Support for WPR comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company.
Support also comes from Visit Winona, where lake and river water trails provide the opportunity to glide, paddle, and drift through the summer. Visit Winona.com. This is the year to discover Winona's outdoors. Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering the Wisconsin mobile app in Android, iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch for checking balances, paying bills, and more. Mobile banking demo, app, and details at wisconsincu.org.
Spectrum Memo, it's the opening of an exhibit featuring artwork by Sister Christine Haugen. From Amory, it's called The Desert Blooms. It opens Friday at 7:30 p.m. and will be up through November 12th at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts, also in Amory, celebrating their 25th anniversary. Way to go, guys. Simply Magic, a sweet Adeline's quartet, performs Saturday evening at the Erica Quam Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. Showtime, 7:30. Autumn Fest is Saturday in St. Croix Falls. Several events happen at both the Overlook Deck and the St. Croix River Visitors Center, beginning at 10 a.m. Pinkalicious opens Friday from the Eau Claire Children's Theater. That's at the Oxford. Info at ecct.org. Spectrum West for a Thursday, the third day of October. I'm Al Ross. Nice to have you with us. I've been to the diminutive in stature yet sizable in character studio in which Eric Lee does his thing. Or might I now amend that to be things, because on this visit to his retreat in Eau Claire's near southwest side, I wasn't there to talk about his paintings, although one in progress did catch my eye. No, I was there to talk about his drums, the custom snare drums he produces with the same style and imagination he employs when at an easel. Or a mural. Hey, Eric, do you create a drum, build a drum, or just make a drum?
I don't know. I guess I just make a drum.
You just make a drum.
Yeah.
But see, you're an artist, so where do the two meet when you're building a snare drum?
Well, I guess in the design and then the sound. You know, it's funny, a lot of people, they want to make the sound the primary thing about a drum, and I guess it has to be. That's its purpose, right? But for me, it's about how it looks, how it feels, what it does for the person who's playing it, if it meets their sort of expectations and personality, not to mention their music style and how they play. I'll put it this way. I'm not a science-minded guy, so I don't do a lot of one-to-one comparisons between one drum or another, mm-hmm. or even one kind of wood and another. I have a handle on the basics and then just go from there. Mm-hmm. So it's more of an art, I guess, in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Because you're an artist, how a drum sounds is important, but then again, you just answered my question about it has to look good in order to be something that comes from your shop. Do people come to you and tell you exactly what kind they want or what they want in it or what they want it to sound like, what they want it to look like to match the personality thing you were talking about?
Yeah, sometimes that happens. I've had everything from having a few on stock where someone likes it and they'll buy that one, to having a guy want to have his hands in every bit of the build, at, you know, every aspect of the build process. So,
right.
Yeah, like, well, there's one over here that's for a guy in Georgia that's going to be leaving this week, and he designated that he wanted rock maple and black walnut striped, and he designated the dimensions of the drum, the depth, the diameter, what kind of bearing edge, the hardware. So it was up to me to put all those things together. And then he asked for advice along the way, you know, what would this do? Say, let's say the venting, what kind of vent would you recommend if I wanted this sound quality or if I wanted this kind of characteristic out of the drum? But he had a good idea already, and he even designed his own badge for that one.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning. Eric Lee, drums, where does that come from?
I've played drums for, well, I don't know, since I was a kid, I guess. Was in the La Crosse Blue Stars as well for just one season, a drum corps. Got to know the snare drum as a unique thing. Mm-hmm. But then more recently, I used to move around a lot and had to dump my kit and only went around with a practice pad for years and years. And when I got back to Eau Claire and started school here, I wanted to get going and playing again and didn't have any drums. I just had a couple of bits laying around. So I went on eBay, got a shell, and started actually assembling drums from raw shells. And I learned right there I like that about as much as I like playing them, maybe even a little more, really. And one thing led to another. And the big opportunity for me actually was I got the drum tech for Bon Iver. There's no better learning experience than, you know, going around the country at different venues with top flight players and top flight audio equipment and drums, and getting to hear how all these things relate to the audience and to the audio engineers, to the people playing them, to the musicians on stage. There's no comparison. You can't do that anywhere else.
For those people out there who don't know what a drum tech is, tell us what a drum tech does.
Anything from getting the equipment, the drums off the truck, to setting them up and tuning them, to just sort of maintaining them in general, making sure everything's tight so there's no mishaps playing, you know, live. But mostly it's keeping them tuned to both the player and to the audio engineer and what they want to get out of the drums for that room. So it's sort of taking the temperature of a room. Well, everything figures into this. This was a summer tour, and so there was humidity and heat issues. It was whether it was indoors or outdoors. The room itself, how large it was, how hard it was. The engineer, Brian Joseph, would go around with some device that I frankly don't know what it's called, and he would sort of take the temp of the room. And this did relate also to how the drums would react. Also, the drums would change their personality as they would warm up throughout the day or cool off, as it might be. If they're in the truck, let's say it's 90 degrees outside, you bring them into an air-conditioned theater, they're going to change. And so you have to be able to adjust and make them sound good. And basically, try not to be a headache for the audio engineers is the whole goal. less on their plate. I mean, if they're running 70, 80 channels, they don't want to have to be concerned with like an annoying snare drum or a drum that just is ringing sympathetically because it's not, you know, it's too tight in frequency to the other drums or misbehaving. They don't want to have to deal with it. So the best you can get it tuned up so that they don't have to worry about it, that's kind of the goal.
Eric Lee, our guest on Spectrum West, and he and I are standing in his workshop. He's been on the program as an artist in the past, but today we're talking about his proficiency for building drums. Are you sort of surprised at, I can use the word success, I mean, you get somebody from Georgia ordering one.
Well, yeah, actually I am. I'm pretty crummy at advertising and PR stuff, whatever it's called. I'm just not too good at that. I have a website and a Tumblr and a Facebook, and that's it.
And today that's almost all, that's all you need.
Yeah, well, lucky for me, I guess. But there's been a lot of local support. I mean, there's been a lot of buyers around here. And look, they don't have to buy what I'm building. They could go to any music store or a guitar center. They could order online. I mean, most people order online, even instruments they haven't heard before. That's sort of becoming the norm. So it's been really great.
Now, a snare drum is made up of a lot of components, and I think your art is in the body of it, the wood part. You have components that you have to shop for. How do you know what to get and where to get them?
Yeah, well, I've tried and continue to try different things, but I've sort of looked all over online when it comes to hardware, lugs, hoops, things that I don't right now build myself, generally called hardware, and I've sort of narrowed it down to what I consider to be the highest quality stuff that I personally can find. And it also depends on budgets. If, let's say, a drummer wants something, but they have only X amount to spend, well, how I have it set up is I get X amount for a shell build, and I make them aware of what the shell costs, and then how they want to option it up from there is completely up to them, and they know where their money's going then. And that's how I send estimates and invoices, is so they know exactly where it's going. I don't charge a penny for hardware. So if they want to opt for a dollar lug versus a $7, $8 lug, you know, that keeps the cost down. If I build them myself, I tend to go on the higher side, the more higher quality side and the more unique side. There's a number of drum builders out there, so I'm trying to distinguish myself with designs and combinations so that it's a little bit different when they get something from me.
Is a whole set of drums in your plan someday?
Well, you know, yeah. I just finally got around to modifying my cheap lathe, so now it has a much
better... We're looking at it as we talk.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a lot, but it finally now has it where it counts, I guess. It's got a variable speed motor, which means I'm not taking my life into my hands now. I can control things and get just a lot more precision and fine-tuning out of this thing. And also means I can turn pretty much anything I want. Right now, I'm focusing on the snare drum still, but I do have plans. They're all ready to go. I just need to do it.
How about woods? Where do you get those from?
Yeah, that's kind of fun. I've got them everywhere from reclaimed wood from old granaries. This guy right here.
It has kind of a checkerboard pattern.
This one is built for a jazz player, J.T. Bates. He's in Minneapolis. This is made almost entirely out of 700- to 800-year-old oak from the Globe Elevator in Superior, Wisconsin.
No kidding.
So it's a very interesting, and for my money, one of the best-sounding snare drums I've ever
Did he request that?
Yeah, he approached me because I was making it known that I wanted to do more reclaimed wood drums. Yeah, that was the selling point for him. And since then, I've had a lot more requests for that. So I'm going to be making a trip up there and getting more of that wood. They come in huge blocks, so I actually have to hand saw them and get them all ready first. Then I plane them, then they go into a drum.
And that's close to your heart.
Yeah, definitely. That's it's as close as it gets because that's sort of my old stomping ground. So, and I was very happy to find that it sounds good. It would have been a disappointment if it sort of, you know, sucked. But
yeah, that's true.
It sounds very good.
So a lathe. I'm trying to envision what do you need a lathe for in making a drum?
What I make are segmented or stave-style drums, which means think of a whiskey barrel, okay? They have vertical running, grain-oriented vertically drums that are glued end-to-end into a circle. And then you throw them on the lathe and mill them down, and that's how you get your roundness. And the same goes for segmented. And segmented drums, which is this kind of drum here from the Globe Elevator, is where the grain's running horizontally, and that's more of a block pattern. Basically the same concept, but there are differences in sound and look. You run into all sorts of issues. I've had to overcome, the first year to year and a half of doing this, I ran into all sorts of problems. I had to get real creative. What I guess that's code for not having the money to do it right. Or I couldn't get the good equipment, so I had to come up with a way to make it happen with stuff I could afford. It's been working out real well. And the whole name of the game now is refining it, you know, getting the basics to the point where it's second nature, and then I get to play around with design more, and that's where I'm at right now.
You are a pretty accomplished visual artist as well, and obviously there's a visual side to your snare drums. I see some work here. Are you still able to do the visual arts, and how do you allot time for each one? I suppose snare drum orders come in and you have to fill them.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, that's for sure. I have a show in Hudson right now for the paintings, a big show at the Phipps. I have a smaller show here in Eau Claire right now, and I have a couple orders that I have to get ready right now for drums. So I've been lucky, if you could put it that way, in the timing. As it's been, I'll usually have a dry spell on the painting, and then it starts to, you know, come in for the drums. So, yeah, it's a balancing act. They each take a lot of time. I can say, though, for the drum thing, the name of the game is to refine it, but also to get it more efficient so that I can, for basic designs anyway, knock them out a little more efficiently. I mean, it took me well over a month to get something where I needed it to be, and now I can do it in probably a week and a half for a shell. And way better than I used to be able to do it.
What do you have to know about the rest of a person's kit to build a snare that fits it?
Generally, if I have a handle on what they're playing and talk to them for a little while, then I know where they're coming from. It's it's funny, over the past couple few years, it only takes a conversation or two to know where they're coming from. So usually it has to do with what they're playing and who they are. And I have, by the way, before I do anything for a drummer, if I'm building them one, I have to get to know them a little. I mean, I can't, I can't just build them one and hope for the best. They have to tell me as much as they can about what they want and who they are. And yeah, actually, I do ask them what kind of kit they're running with. And that right there tells me the character. It's funny. It's kind of like car guys. Yeah. You know? Yeah, not much difference, really.
Are they all the same size? Number one, that's the first part of the question. And number two, is there a difference between old snare drums and new snare drums, what they're expected to do?
Yeah, there's big differences. There's a huge thing with vintage gear these days where it's to the point where some of the major manufacturers are trying to emulate the old building techniques of, say, the 30s, but mostly 40s, 50s, and 60s. This is mostly for guys who are going for the quote, vintage sound. And what that means is thinner walls and reinforcement rings, basically the only way they built drums for decades, but that drum companies throughout the 80s, 90s, and until now hadn't really been doing anymore. So if people wanted a classic, that classic rock sound, say from the 60s, or if they wanted a classic jazz sound from the 60s or 50s or something, they'd have to get vintage gear. But now there's a number of companies that are emulating that. So back to your question, your first question of depths and sizes. Mike Malone right now is requesting a 13-inch diameter drum. That's a little smaller than the standard. Most drums are 14 for snare drums. And because it's smaller, it's going to have a little more pop, a little more high end. But that's just one of its traits. You know, depth figures in what kind of bearing edges, those who don't know what those are, that's what the drum head itself sits on around the rim of the drum. That's where the wood comes into contact with the drum head. That determines it, the kind of wood, the kind of hoops, what kind of vents are involved in the drum, because the air cushion inside a snare drum is very important to how the drum sounds. All these things figure in.
Snare drum 101, let's give people an idea of what's inside a snare drum. There is a lever that allows them to become a snare drum, and it's kind of a sizzle type thing.
They're called snares. Back in the old days, they were made out of anything from string to catgut. Typically, for most drum set players, it's steel or brass coils. They're engaged or disengaged with what's called a throw-off lever on the snare drum, and that means you have them on, which you get a snare drum sound, or you have them off, which means you get more of a, you know, basic drum sound. How tight they are, how loose they are, determines a great deal on how much the drum rings. If they're tight, the drum is more dampened. You get more of a tight, crisp pop that way. If they're loose, you get more of a washy, loose sound. You can have a brittle or very warm drum depending just on the snares and just on how you have them set.
Well, there we go. Eric Lee, thanks so much for being with us. I thought I knew a lot about snare drums. Turns out I didn't know anything.
Well, I'm learning to this day. There's a lot more I'm learning, so that's the fun, just to keep learning.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So now you've satisfied that learning something new requirement for today. No need to thank me, but thanks to Eric Lee, I hope you could imagine it all in your mind, an old converted one-car garage where cool things happen. Again, you can see a lot at oliversnaredrums.com. Isn't that a coincidence? Oliver. Because now we're going to talk about Jim Oliver, who continues to heal from his hip surgery. I'm certain he's feeling your best wishes coming across the hills and dales of western Wisconsin. And through the miracle of electronics, he again contributes to yet another episode of Spectrum West. And this week, Jim focuses on Barron, Wisconsin.
The Diary of Anne Frank, a play by Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, opened in New York in 1955. The play received the Tony Award for Best Play and the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. The Diary of Anne Frank was revived in 1997 in a new adaptation by Wendy Kesselman. The Barron Spotlighters production of The Diary of Anne Frank will open Thursday, October 10th, and run through the 20th at the Barron Area Community Center. Joining us to talk about the Barron Spotlighters production is the director, Stephen Mitchell. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
So what got you interested in The Diary of Anne Frank?
Well, this is a very interesting story, you know, in the World War II period, and it covers the horrors of the Holocaust, Nazi persecution. But I think it's also a character study of how people face challenges of prejudice and hatred, and it kind of encourages people to have a positive outlook on things. So in reading through the script, and I've also seen the movie Diary of Anne Frank, it really made me pause and think about, you know, the challenges that people face in their lives that are not as severe as this, and, you know, how do we face those challenges every day? And so I was always interested in this for a number of years, and when I was asked to direct it, I was more than happy to accept.
So talk a little bit about, everybody pretty much knows the story, I guess, but talk a little bit about what the story is about.
There is the Frank family. The father, whose name is Otto Frank, he is the owner of a business, and in this business there is an annex that ultimately becomes a secret annex. Nobody's ever used it, really, and it's additional rooms to the side of the building. And in Amsterdam, when the Nazis have invaded and they've basically started to put all the Jews in the population on lockdown and starting to ship them out to concentration camps, the Frank family and also the Von Dahn family decide that they need to go into hiding. Mr. Von Dahn is also a business partner of Mr. Frank, and so those two families move into this secret annex together, and later on they're joined by another man that needs to find a place to hide, and that is his name is Mr. Dussel. There's also children of these two, you know, in these two families. The Frank families have, of course, Anne, who is the most famous of all the names that you probably hear, and Margaret, who is her older sister. And then the Von Dahn family have a son whose name is Peter. And so, you know, it's living in this confined space and basically having to hide and learn how to be respectful of other people in this situation and responsible to the other people to avoid a capture. And it also has a couple of other characters that are involved that help these people. They were actually employees of Mr. Frank, a woman named Meep Geese, and also a Mr. Crawler, who would come and bring them news or books, food. They pretty much counted on them for everything. In this story, it covers that period of 2 years that they're actually hid away in this annex up until the time that they are finally captured.
So who do you have in the cast?
Well, we have a very talented young woman, Hannah Carlson, who plays Anne Frank. Her father, Scott Carlson, plays Otto Frank, who is the father in the play as well. And they're from Cameron. Edith Frank is played by Mary Shuey from Rice Lake. Margaret Frank, the older sister, is played by Gabby Ashland from Rice Lake. Meep Geese, who is one of the women, one of the employees that helps to bring food to them and other supplies, is played by Jody Swanson, also of Cameron. Mr. Van Dahn is played by Jackson Liddle of Rice Lake. Mrs. Von Dahn is played by Shannon Paul of Rice Lake. Peter Von Dahn, their son, is played by Malachi Anderson of Cameron. Mr. Dussel, who is the older man that comes partway into the play and needs a place to stay as well, is played by David Mitchell of Elmina. And Mr. Crawler, who is also one of the employees that helps to supply them, is played by Shane Miller of Bloomer.
He is Stephen Mitchell, who is director of the Baron Spotlighters production of The Diary of Anne Frank. I'm always interested in the set building and if there are any challenges in staging this show.
Not anything particularly challenging, I suppose. I guess the most challenging thing is trying to show three different levels of a home on the same stage. And so what we do is we kind of stagger the heights of a couple of risers, I think, and to show as a different floor. There was actually three different floors that they were staying on with a stair ladder up to the, between the different floors.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we can't do something like that. You know, so that probably is the most difficult part as far as the staging is concerned.
Who did the set building for you?
Well, we haven't got it built yet, but we're working on it. Steve DeMars is in charge of that, and Derek Rogers. They are both excellent at what they do, and they're going to be building that for us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your previous experience in the theater. What caused you to get bitten by this disease that seems to afflict so many people? When did you get started in the theater?
I'll tell you, I had never done anything with the theater in my life until, I don't know, about 9 years ago, I suppose it was, or maybe 10. My children were involved in a play, Beauty and the Beast. And my youngest son, was, I believe, 4 or 5 at the time. He played Chip, and he had never been in anything. None of them had been involved in theater. But I really got interested in how they were performing. I started coming to their shows. I went to probably 8 out of their 10 performances because I was just so thrilled to see them up there acting. And one of the directors asked me if I would be in the fall production that they were doing. I was very reluctant, but then my youngest kept on saying, "Dad, you can do that." And I thought, well, if my 5-year-old son can get up there and not be afraid, I suppose I could probably try it. So I took a small part, and then one thing led to another, and I just became immersed in the theater, and I've been in love with it ever since.
Now, you've directed up at Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. Is this your first time down at Barron?
Yes, this is my first time directing at Barron Spotlighters. I've been involved in, I believe, 3 different plays at Spotlighters. I was in their High Society production, also in Seussical, and I can't recall the 3rd one, but it was a small part, so it's no wonder.
Yeah. What have you directed before?
I've directed Anything Goes, which is a musical. My preference is plays because it's just so much more. Well, I'm not great at the dancing part and coordinating that, and I'm not great at the music part. I don't need any of that when I'm directing a play, and so that makes it a whole lot easier for me to work on these. But My 3 Angels, I directed at Northern Star, See How They Run, the Farndale Halloween show that they had. So I've had some experience up there at Northern Star, but never before at Spotlighters, and I'm just really thrilled to be able to work with them again.
Well, we've been visiting with Stephen Mitchell, director of the Barron Spotlighters production of The Diary of Anne Frank. The show opens Thursday, October 10th, and runs through the 20th at the Barron Area Community Center. For ticket information, you can use your favorite internet search engine to find the Barron Spotlighters. Stephen Mitchell, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Jim Oliver, for another stellar contribution to the program Spectrum West. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Music from Beethoven, Bruckner, and Schubert is featured in the concert Discover the Great Symphony Saturday, October 12th at the State Theater. Details at 832-6366 or at cvsymphony.org.
Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com.
Al Ross here with Spectrum West for the 3rd of October. After talking with them and setting up a phone conversation, I've tried to remember how I heard about the Ericssons. And there's no happy ending to that part of the story because I can't. For the life of you, I don't get me involved if I don't have to, recall where I first heard they were good. But suffice it to say, I'm mighty glad I did. They shipped me their newest CD, The Wild, and I was hooked on their sound. That I liken to the expanse of a big SUV, yet with the closeness, as in harmonies, of a subcompact. And I wager they'll also get a lot of mileage out of the compilation. They've lived in West Wisconsin, have moved around a bit. Now they have a 612 area code, and the number I called was supposed to be Jenny's, but Bethany answered. And that's how close they are. Did you guys play and sing together as kids and teens? I'm guessing you did.
Yeah, in a very different way. I mostly played the piano growing up, so I would just kind of like, we would have all of the sheet music, you know, songbooks, and Jenny would sing. And we actually have an older sister, too, who would sing along. And I actually didn't start singing until, like, later in high school. My voice, like, changed over or something, but it was pretty brutal for a while. So yeah, a lot of music, and our dad was really, his work wasn't music-related, but he was always buying the latest, you know, CD and seeking out new artists, and so we were really exposed to a lot of good music growing up.
In the beginning, the formation of the Ericssons was full of emotion and purpose and dedication. Many entertainers talk about their early days with pride for having paid their dues and enduring lean times. Yours is a story that certainly has the hardship, but it's of a different color. Tell us and our audience briefly about the origins of who you guys are today.
Well, as you were alluding to, kind of the heartbreak of it all,
I was married to an artist, Lee, and he passed away in 2006, which was kind of right when we were just sort of musically stirring a lot, and I was writing a lot, and Jenny and I lived together. Well, she came to live with me and with Lee when he was passing away, and so we were just together, you know, and he was a big supporter of even as loose as we, you know, were back then musically, and we had no real focus or direction, but he was a huge supporter of the sound or whatever he could even hear at that point, you know?
Sure.
So we just kept on with it, you know? Again, in life, I mean, there's nothing more intense than, you know, life and death stuff.
You
so,
yeah,
you know, when you encounter it so intimately and then moving forward from there, it was all, I just knew it was what I loved, you know, writing the music and I knew it was what I would be committed to.
Uh-huh. Given all that stuff, you were a songwriter, you had some songs, Jenny, a musician as well, and obviously it appears that music is what got you guys through the rain.
Yeah, I think so. Plus a few other things, too, you know, just a lot of writing in general. But the music, you know, it's such a deep form of expression, such a true form of expression, you know, and I think anyone getting through a really difficult time or situation, I mean, if a person isn't kind of continually expressing where they're at, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, and just processing, I think you can get pretty stuck emotionally.
Yeah, no kidding. That's the voice of Bethany Valentini, who, along with Jenny Kaepernick, are a sister act called the Ericksons. It would appear that the Ericksons is kind of a tribute. Is that what it's meant to be?
You know, it wasn't. I think a lot of choices we make are subconscious. I really do, you know, because it is such a tribute. But how it came to be was we were playing at the same open mic in Brooklyn, New York, every Tuesday night, and we would get up and we would, you know, we'd say, "Oh, hey, I'm Bethany," and she'd say, "Oh, I'm Jenny." We didn't have our act together, if you will, you know. So we kind of put our heads together and said, "You know, we need to call ourselves something, so people know what to call us." My name at the time was Erickson, and she just said, "Well, why don't we be the Ericksons?"
I like it.
I said, "All right."
I read people didn't understand it in New York. There were not a lot of Scandinavians and stuff, you said. Yeah.
Well, it made it kind of exotic.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Brooklyn. I read that you took a trip to India, then to Brooklyn, then you moved back to the Midwest. Was all that moving calculated to help you evolve, or were you just following your noses at the time?
Following our noses, for sure. Every step we've taken, we've been true to this love of the music and this a deep pursuit of whatever it is. But it certainly hasn't meant we've, you know, known what we've needed all the time or known, you know, where we would kind of end up. We always knew New York wasn't our home.
Sure.
But we had no idea how we'd get back to a home or where the Midwest is our home.
Sure.
But the road was certainly not clear until it became clear.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, not intended, but a very nice, nice result. Yeah. When I listen to your stuff, and it's nice to listen to. One technique that I enjoy is the fact that you're breathing is part of the rhythm of the songs.
Ooh.
And you know, I may be a sheltered musical hermit, but that feels unique to me. Is that kind of a natural tendency, or is it written into your stuff?
Ooh, it's very natural, and I think we'd have to just chalk it up to the being siblings. But also just singing together for so many years now and kind of following one another. You know, generally, I write the melodies and Jenny, she can write any harmony, just supremely beautiful harmonies. You know, like when we perform live, it's a lot of interweaving, a lot of actively, you know, being together, singing together, finding that one breath.
Sure, you know.
Which is kind of what it is then.
You do those little staccato things and then you take a breath between each one and it's kind of a step thing, and I think that's kind of neat.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, cool. That's Bethany, who along with her sister Jenny makeup, the duo called the Ericksons. Their new CD is called The Wild. And from that CD, here's a little bit of Gone Blind.
These eyes of mine have all but gone blind. I keep walking around, staring at the time. But my heart soars and my voice roars as I open up the pain. Yeah, my blood flows in my nose. I got to drain it out my veins.
Suffered in the past the way you guys have, or you have personally, even though it may not be the direction, the past, that you want to glance, it is a tendency to do that, and yet you have a need to look forward to things. I'm talking about the songs on The Wild now. Are they songs that you had to dig real deep to get, or did you just discover them lying on the surface, like maybe picking up a shell on the beach? What?
Yeah.
In other words, the translation to that is, did you have to work up a sweat or just find the words right under there?
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That is an awesome question. But the answer is, truthfully, both. I think what really happened with The Wild is I started playing the electric guitar shortly before we kind of wrote that album. All of a sudden, it just gave us this new breadth of sound and more sound. And I think it was just a tool to enable us to dig a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
We generally write, the music comes first, and then we just kind of like, you know, find a sound and commit ourselves to it. And we find that then the words are kind of like that shell on a beach. They're just kind of there. But it takes that willingness to find the sound and to, you know, find the time and the space to go someplace real, you know, to go someplace deeper.
The song kind of just leads you along.
Yes, definitely.
You know, we talked about healing and all that stuff. I can imagine. I can imagine live performances are good for you guys. I mean, applause is medicine for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, and I think more than applause, even just, you know, just the physical act of sharing with people, you know, having them receive this kind of work of art. So the songs are kind of created new in a way every time we perform them. So I think that's what it is. I think it's the interplay between us and other people, because if someone cares about, you know, what you've created and what you're doing, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah.
And not only cares, but if it can mean something to other people, that's what it's about.
True.
You know, it obviously means so much to the two of us, then that next step of, you know, other people can take it on and feel it.
I know on the CD you have a bunch of bandmates. You have drums and you have steel guitar and some other stuff. Do you appear as a duet or do you take other people on stage with you?
We do both. Recently, we've done a lot just as a duo and kind of expanding our own roles And like we've added a little bit of keyboard, a little bit of synthesizer, just played by the two of us. But we're going to do an Iowa tour, and our pedal steel player is going to come along.
Neat.
Yeah. So keeping it fluid in that way, you know, not defining it, you know, just as a duo, or as at least at this point.
That's always nice to give people a surprise. It's like reaching into a cereal box. You never know what you're going to get. Yeah. Or like, what's his name? Forrest Gump, the chocolate thing.
Right.
Bethany, not that it means much, but my compliments on the CD. It's a lot of music to listen to. I enjoy it. I'm going to continue to enjoy it. Keep up the great work with Jenny and all the other people in which you're involved.
Yeah.
How was the recording session? I understand you did it in our neighborhood.
Yeah, we did. It was great. I think we finished about three tracks. And in terms of our writing now, we kind of know where we're headed a little bit. So it was a beautiful time.
Is April Bass Studio a place that you may revisit?
I sure hope so. Just it's ideal in almost every way. It's beautiful, and the equipment is amazing, and the feel of it all is just really relaxed and homey. So we would sure love to if we can get in there again. Absolutely.
I appreciate you being with us here on Spectrum West. Say hello to Jenny. I didn't get to talk to her, but say hi to her.
I sure will.
Bethany and Jenny both have married last names, but they still go by the name The Ericsons. They're making quite a name for themselves in music. They played at the Cabin at UW-Eau Claire last Friday, so there's a good chance you'll be able to see them in our neighborhood before too long. The CD is The Wild. It's a song on the CD, and Jenny says it's who we are and what we do. Spectrum Memo October features a new adventure at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman is on stage for four weekends. Reservations online at festivaltheater.org and by phone. It's a fundraiser for the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, Saturday 6 to 10 p.m., featuring singer-songwriter Carrie Noble from the Twin Cities Entertainment, hors d'oeuvres, cash bars, silent auction, raffles, and dessert reception. Semi-formal dress, by the way. Tickets at 235-0001. Well, time has flown. We've spent the better part of an hour together, and you won't believe how grateful I am that you chose to be here today. Thanks to Rachel Vick, Jim Oliver, and you for spending time in our Spectrum West. Lots more next week, Thursday, 10 a.m. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend.